This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at sd.net.
Welcome to the Senate Democratic Press Conference. I'm Billy Sutton, District 21 Senator and Senate Minority Leader. And with me is Spence Hawley, the House Minority Leader. As we usually and typically do, we'll start with some opening comments and then open it up for questions. And what we typically like to do is talk about what our priorities are and what we see coming for legislation that we're bringing and different agenda items that we're talking about. So to start, one thing that we've noticed is that working families are having to work harder to make ends meet, and many are falling behind. We're first in the nation in multiple job holding rates at 8.7%, when the national average is 4.9%. We're 44th in median earnings for men and 46th for women. But what we've noticed is that it's pretty incredibly silent on the other side of the aisle as it comes to a discussion about how to help the working class. Today we're unveiling the Opportunity Agenda for Working Families. That's going to consist of five main bills that we're looking at and working on. I'll list those and then we'll go into a little more detail as we go along. Funding the needs-based scholarship adequately, pre-K pilot program, increased child care assistance, support for paid sick leave and family leave, funding Building South Dakota adequately, and removing the sales tax on food. If our agenda is passed, it would be a huge boost for working families in South Dakota. This plan will help all South Dakotans and their communities reach their full potential, no matter where they are from. I'll let Spence start out discussing a couple of our agenda items, and then I'll wrap it up with a couple of the other ones, and then we'll take questions.
Yeah, thanks, Billy. I just want to address the needs-based scholarship. We've talked about this in the past, and I've used the example. When I went to college several years ago at SDSU, the state paid 60% of my tuition, and I paid 40% of that tuition. Now, when a student goes up to SDSU, the state pays 38% of the tuition, and the student pays 62% of the tuition. We've had a total cost shift of the cost of education at the high at college level. And the problem is that the medium, lower-income families are not able to pick that difference up now. And the bad news is South Dakota was the last state to establish a needs-based scholarship. We did that in my second year out here, and we threw $1 million into the fund. Right now, we've got an account, a needs-based scholarship account, with a critical need, teachers need a scholarship account, and we got $6.5 million in that account total. That generates the interest income for scholarships of $147,000 a year. And that $147,000 is divided between students at six universities. So you can do the math and realize that it really isn't an appreciable account. And it's difficult with our finances we have to get that funded way up where it needs to, but I think we need to continue the discussion. I think we need to set aside another $2 million this year and one-time dollars into the account and keep the discussion going on that. The other big discussion we've had goes back to Senate Bill 235 in 2013, where we set up Building South Dakota. The problem with Building South Dakota at that time, we identified unclaimed property as the funding source for this account. It was generating about $7 to $10 million a year. When unclaimed property numbers went up dramatically the next year, the governor came back and said, "No, we don't want to give you 50% of that account anymore. So we'll set $30 million aside, and you can use that money to fund Building South Dakota." The problem we got is that money has not been replenished outside of a small amount coming in from contractors' excise tax. So at the end of, in 2018, that money's going to run out in Building South Dakota. There's a Housing Opportunity Fund, which is one of the five accounts in there. That money has run out. So what we're proposing is that we would like to backfill $2.5 million into the Housing Fund for the fiscal year 2018 to help with low-income housing on individual home ownership and rental properties. And then we want to propose a bill that says in 2019 we want this for ongoing funding of $10 million into Building South Dakota. The plan is, if we have the discussion now, the governor was able to have time to build it into his 2019 budget for ongoing.
I'll hit a couple of the other topics. The pre-K education, we're bringing a bill to create a pilot program for pre-K. The goal there would be to have a special appropriation for of one time $5 million. And the goal would be to have a competitive grant program similar to what North Dakota has done. It would offer $2,500 per student for eligible public schools to take advantage of. If they don't have a program, they could use that to create a program. Just some comments about pre-K and looking at some research that's out there. Individuals that go through pre-K are, as grown-ups, make an average of $2,000 more per month once they are in the job market. They're more likely to hold a job. There's less crime in society that has a higher percentage of people that went through pre-K, and they're more likely to graduate high school as well. For every dollar invested, there's a $7 to $10 gain, which is a huge return on investment. Right now in South Dakota, we have 27,000 kids, or 43% of the children in our state under age 6 living in poverty. Only 13% of 3- and 4-year-olds in South Dakota are enrolled in pre-K. The other challenge that is faced with this, and that it ties hand in hand, is support for child care. Right now, I think it's important that we talk about the family need for affordable child care to be in the workforce. Right now in South Dakota, there is support for child care, but it's a scaled system below 175% of federal poverty level. And that is about $42,000 for a family of four. So once you get below that level, or you're above that $42,000, there is no support for child care. $42,000 a year for a family of four is not a lot of money. For many working families, access to affordable, reliable, and high-quality child care and early education is a necessity to attain and maintain a job and foster the learning and development of their young children. This is truly an economic issue that benefits everyone in our state. Along with that, we're looking at legislation to offer support for paid family leave and paid sick leave. We'll have more details on that to come because the bill is not drafted yet, but we're working out the details on it. And then finally, the removal of sales tax on food. This is something we've been talking about for a long time. We will have a bill that will be revenue neutral, so it will be no tax increase, remove it on food, and the sales tax on everything else goes up to meet the net cost. One-fourth or 230,000 South Dakotans are at or below 200% of federal poverty level. By removing the tax on food, it could save working families 3 weeks of groceries or $300 to $400 a year in savings. It's also important to note that 42 out of 46 states that have a sales tax have exemptions or lower rates for groceries. We are the only state in our region that taxes food. The only state in our region that taxes food, with making us the fourth most regressive taxation state in the country. So with that, I think we'll open up for questions and look forward to answering anything that you guys have questions on. I think typically it's about a 0.3% increase, if I remember correctly, 0.33, something of that nature. We've had bills on this in the past, and I think that's what it was. But I would rely on Ray Ring, who's going to prime the bill, to have the exact information on that. The removal of sales tax on food typically for the state sales tax is about $85 million. And so when you decrease $85 million, you have to raise it $85 million on the other portion. When we raised it a half penny, I think that brought in around $115 million. So something in that ballpark.
Have you had conversations with Republican leadership at all about any of these proposals? If not, how are you hoping to approach that conversation? If so, have they been receptive?
on a couple of them, I've addressed the needs-based scholarship. There has been an appetite out there. The truth of the problem in the needs-based for the dollars we're asking is that we need to get our ask on the table. And I think there is an appetite as we get down into the budgeting appropriation process. On the needs-based, or I'm sorry, on the Building South Dakota, I've had quite a bit of discussion across the aisle there, and I have found that across the aisle in the House and in the Senate, there is real concern that we keep Building South Dakota going. Probably the biggest thing on that is it was a legislative initiative originally, and it was a good bipartisan legislative initiative, and we would like to keep it bipartisan, and I have found that there is a large appetite for it there.
On sort of a separate note, congressional Republicans have started working toward repealing and potentially replacing the Affordable Care Act. What concerns do you have for South Dakota and health care here if that were to be repealed with or without replacement right away?
Well, the obvious concern is the health care for the people of South Dakota. You know, we've picked up, 27,000 people have picked up insurance under the ACA Act in South Dakota that didn't have insurance before. And that's a huge number for our small population. The second issue is when we did away with our fund to back up for uninsurables. If you couldn't buy insurance, we had the backup plan in South Dakota for the uninsurable pool. If you remember, we got rid of that last year. We raided that for money and took the money out of there. So that backup doesn't exist for people in South Dakota anymore. So just the affordable health care, you know, we've already seen the impact. We were this close, in my mind, to getting the Medicaid expansion to bring the coverage to 50,000 people. That is now off the table. So those are the concerns, is how do we keep providing coverage? There's no doubt the people that are insured through group health plans, they probably won't notice a big difference. There won't be major changes for them. But the individual that's out there trying to buy it, especially the middle income and the low income, the ones I deal with in my office trying to find health insurance, that's where I'm really concerned about.
And it's something that we should all be concerned about. Even if you have insurance, you need to be concerned about this. Because if we don't get coverage for the people that can't afford it, there is going to be no limit to the increasing cost of health care. Because when an individual that doesn't have health care goes in to the emergency room and can't pay for it, and it's written off as charity care, or the hospital just has to figure out a way to eat it, that we all pay more. We all pay more for the cost of health care and increasing premiums in health care. So until we get a solution to where we get people covered before it's too late, before it's the wrong time, the wrong cost, and the wrong place in the emergency room, so that we have preventative care for those folks and they have coverage, we're going to continue to see healthcare costs go up, and we're really not addressing the issue. So I'll be interested to see what type of replacement plan that they propose, but I think they're going to find a tough road, decreasing the cost of healthcare while trying to cover people that, you know, if they don't have a plan to cover people that can't afford it.
You know, and this is a federal discussion, so we're not in the discussion, but from in the health insurance business, the repeal, they want to repeal it to reduce cost, and then when the stuff I read, they say, but there's things that we think are important to keep, and we think we want to keep the no pre-existing conditions is really important. We want to keep the removal of the $1 million caps most plans have and go unlimited. We want to keep that you allow the student on until age 26. Those are the specific items that cost money, and that's what had raised the cost up. So I'm just standing by, waiting to see how they're going to address those issues and still get those goals achieved.
Well, and at this point, there are no excuses. They control the White House. They control both the House and the Senate, and it's on them. There are no excuses. They said they were going to fix this problem. They said they were going to repeal and fix it. So if they don't, the citizens of the United States better hold them accountable.
Any other questions?
What changed in the last few years regarding the
I don't think anything has changed except that we just feel like it's very important, especially when you compare us to other states and the challenges that South Dakotans have in paying those higher costs for food that we eat. And we're going to keep talking about it every year until we get something done on it. We were probably more hopeful last year that we were going to have a chance to get this done because we were talking about raising the sales tax. Our goal last year, if you remember, was to raise the sales tax a full penny and repeal the tax on food at the same time. And so that would have been the optimal goal, but that discussion is over, and we need to come back to reminding folks the challenges that our working families are having, even putting food on the table. And for a family that is very poor, $300 to $400 can make a huge difference in their life. And I just don't believe it's right that these families have to struggle to put food on the table when we all know we have to eat to survive. And unfortunately, what it forces families also to do when they don't have money to buy healthy food, and it's cheaper to go through McDonald's or Burger King's of the world, then that creates a system where they're even more unhealthy because they're poor. And that is very frustrating to me. We should be having policies that incentivize healthy food and that make it cheaper to buy healthy food and not cheaper to buy food that is not good for you.
I'll address 1035 first. Just came from State Affairs, and actually they're doing some others up there while I'm down here. But 1035 didn't have a problem with. What the concern was on if you want to appeal a petition and just kind of some of the procedures in there and through the Secretary of State's office and what information is needed by her and just clarification. As you know, there were several appeals this last year on candidates and ballot initiatives and measures, and they have found that there's question areas, and they actually had to go talk to the judge about, well, what should we do? So they're just trying to clean that up, and we didn't have a problem with the ones that they presented so far. The ones that I have not seen yet that and they're starting over in the Senate side, or when they're talking about the initiative process and the requirements more stringent on that. That's where, and Billy can probably address, you started over there.
Senate Bill 59, I think, is maybe the other one you're referring to that's in Senate State Affairs today. If you just glance at it, it seemed harmless enough, but when you dig deeper, Section 2 is really problematic and even potentially unconstitutional, which I found to be a little bit interesting as I did research on it. But mainly, it would require an initiated measure to go through the same process that a legislative bill does. And I find that to be very problematic to the initiated measure process. I mean, essentially then we're saying that somebody from the public can come here and propose a bill, and that's what we have already. So that Section 2 is an attack on the initiated measure process and needs to be struck out. As far as changing the date when these initiated measures become effective, I don't think I have a huge issue with that as long as it's reasonable. I think their proposal is July 1st. I would say maybe something like April 1st would be better because that would still allow the legislature, if there were huge problems with the measure, that we could put an emergency to change it. It'd require a two-thirds vote, which I think would be a higher threshold that would be more reasonable. And maybe that's the way we should go. But as far as moving the date, I don't know that we have a huge heartburn on that. Because when it goes into effect, say, 8 days after the election, that can be a little bit problematic for agencies and other departments of government to try to comply. And so understandable. Maybe we should change the date a little bit, but that Section 2 is very problematic to this process.
Yeah, one question and follow-up. Many of you have traveled over the first curious, many of those members will face their first Cracker Barrels. What are you hearing from people back home? Are you hearing from people back home? What's on their minds this session? What's the discussion among your membership here on?
We haven't had our first Cracker Barrels from the last week at home, and they'll start. And so I haven't gotten a ton of feedback from my other members on what it, the IM-22 discussions. It seemed that's, you know, that's in the papers and the newspaper, TV and radio, and that discussion about where we're headed with it is what, and that just is starting kind of what's going to be happening in that process. But that's probably the biggest issue that keeps coming up so far.
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot from constituents and people from all over the state, frankly, through email and phone calls, that they don't want us to mess with the initiated measure process. They do. I have not gotten any emails saying, "Yeah, we need to change. We need to change how we do the initiated measure process. This is a bad deal." I'm hearing people saying, "You know what? We were the first state in the nation to have this, and we like that we have the initiated measure process, and we don't want you messing with it." Just as they spoke out a couple years ago when there was a bill to try to make it twice as hard to get something on the ballot by requiring twice as many signatures, and so. Those types of measures actually fly in the face of what the initiative measure process and how we do things in South Dakota was set up. Because the more requirements you put on the initiative measure process, the more that people with a large amount of money are going to control the ballot. It actually flies in the face of what we should be doing. We should be promoting grassroots and those types of organizations putting things on the ballot, and making it harder to get something on the ballot is going to make it more difficult for the everyday South Dakotan to have a voice on the ballot.
Follow up, if I could.
Real quick, yeah.
Week three, inside baseball, what should we be paying attention to? What's on deck? What should the people back home be watching as the work product in the next 5 days before we see?
So the discussion, and I throw an IM-22 out as the comment. I think that next week that we're going to be getting a lot of the discussion on that. There's some bills that have been dropped, from my understanding, on the repeal side. There's several other bills on fixes. So I think we'll probably start really getting into working on that issue next week is what I see the so far as a discussion.
Yeah, and the House has some challenges they got to deal with.
Yeah, other than our other challenges that we've got to deal with, which we didn't address at the press conference with our committee that we're setting up for the investigation, and just simply because don't know enough to even say anything at this time. And next week we'll be able to have a lot more information for you. Thank you.
Thank you.